minutes past the hour. Welcome to the Molloy program tonight. Thanks for tuning in. We have some sponsors tonight. This first hour is sponsored by Mr. Alex in Phoenix, Arizona.
Wow.
Mr. Alex. Mr. Alex writes, personal sponsors. Holy cow, when did this start? I must have been wasted away again in Margaritaville. I admit I can't listen every night because I have a life. But bless your hearts. Anything I can contribute to help is well invested as far as I'm concerned. Thank you. Signed, Mr. Alex,
meow,
in Phoenix. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Alex. What does that mean,
meow,
Mr. Alex? Well. Hey, listen, support is support, right? We will mention Mr. Alex again in the program. We will. If you want to know what we're talking about here, go to MikeMolloy.com, and on the main page you'll see a tab that says sponsor. Click it. And all sorts of wondrous things will be revealed to you. I've been getting an awful lot of really good emails from people, well-written, well-thought-out, you know, the usual crew, but also people who don't normally write lengthy emails to this program. And they're so good that I just feel like I need to share them. There's a lot of things that I could talk about in this program. I usually do. But sometimes I think that the reason people write to this program and write so well, write to me, is because they know that there's a good chance it's going to wind up going over the air. And I appreciate that because what I try to put out there in terms of emails, I wish I could read every one of them if time allowed. But the ones I put out by reading them on the air, I think are so well done, and that they need to be shared. When people write stuff to me, I hate to think it only comes here. You know, I read it and go, oh, that's really cool, and maybe respond and say, thanks, well written, Joe or Susan or whatever, and hit the delete button. You know, I hate to do that. So I'm going to share some of this with you here in a couple of minutes. But I want to start with something that crossed my desk today from MediaMatters.org, which is a very good source for factual information. This is one of the reasons it's infuriating to some of us on the sensible left to hear someone like Jon Stewart, for example, find equivalence between the garbage that is put out there by right-wing blog sites or right-wing websites or right-wing media, to compare that garbage to the fact-based information that liberal or democratic, or not democratic, forget democratic, but liberal or progressive websites put out, some of which happen to be democratic, some of which are just nonpartisan. They just put it out there because they're tired of hearing all the garbage that the right-wing spews and America gobbles up like so many pigs at a trough. Well, what I'm about to share with you is an example of that. As you know, Eric Cantor, Republican House member from Virginia, is about to be the House Majority Leader. He follows John Boehner around as if the two were joined at the groin. And Eric Cantor is determined to be House Majority Leader, and I don't know that he has any competition when the Republican caucus in the House decides who their leaders are going to be. Eric Cantor is very, 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 very Jewish and very, 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 very much a supporter of Israel, as most Jews in the Congress are. And some of them unqualifiedly so, which in my personal feeling, sometimes it's very difficult for me to accept that unqualified support of an apartheid state like Israel. On the one hand, while on the other hand, some of the Democratic Jewish members of Congress are very progressive, very understanding, very forward-thinking where it concerns every other issue And I get hung up on that sometimes, and I try, unless I'm focusing on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, I try to keep that in mind, that one particular issue does not make or break a member of Congress. It shouldn't, anyway. Keeping all that in mind, Eric Cantor here has crossed the line, egregiously so. And according to Media Matters, he's now desperately trying to explain away the promise he made to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a week ago. Eric Cantor, according to Media Matters, got all huddled with Netanyahu just prior to Netanyahu's meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton last week. Clinton was expected in that meeting to reaffirm the American commitment to Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, and she was expected to continue U.S. opposition, as facile as it may be, to Israeli settlement expansion. Under Netanyahu, the Israeli government doesn't give a damn about the fact that they are continuing to violate Geneva Conventions, to violate the rules that are set out there. If you're going to become an occupier of another country, as we are or were in Iraq, there are certain rules you have to follow in order to be a good occupier as opposed to a bad occupier. You see how crazy this planet has become. Israel is not a good occupier. And one of the things that is specifically prohibited is building permanent settlements on the land belonging to the country you're occupying. That's against the rules. The settlements, the Israeli settlement expansion, has been a serious area of contention, and it should be, on the part of the Palestinians for the past 60 years, ever since this invasion and establishment of the State of Israel occurred. Now, you can be supportive of the establishment of the State of Israel or not, but if you are supportive of the idea and the manner in which it was done, a lot of Jews, American Jews, will say, no, wait a second, this was a UN mandate that established the State of Israel. That is partially true. But if the supporters of Israel are going to focus on a UN resolution establishing the state and then ignore practically every UN resolution since concerning the treatment of the Palestinians by the settlers, by the new arrivals, by the Jews, by the Israelis, that's not logical, it's not fair, and it pisses me off to a very, very big degree. And I think it would irritate most everybody. M.J. Rosenberg, and I mention his name because he is Jewish, wrote at MediaMatters.org what I'm going to share with you when we come back from this break. But Eric Cantor crossed the line, way crossed the line, and I have yet to hear anybody in mainstream media, especially certainly not on the crazy right, go nuts about this. You know, they make up this bull crap about Obama's allegiance lies somewhere else. Well, Eric Cantor's allegiance, by his own words, lies somewhere else. We'll be right back.
Don't worry, economy is making new jobs, but the people who benefit most are breaking bread with every night. doing talk radio right from the left. It's More Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. All right, M.G. Rosenberg, writing at MediaMatters.org, he's talking about soon-to-be House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Cantor got together with Benjamin Netanyahu when the Israeli Prime Minister was in the United States last week, right before meeting with Hillary Clinton. And Clinton was expected to reaffirm what has become the U.S. position. It was the U.S. position during Bush 2, Clinton, Bush 1, and I think even Reagan. That the expansion of the settlements have to stop. There has to be negotiations with the Palestinians. Now, of course, neither of those situations have been honored to a degree that would result in ending this terrible situation in Palestine and Israel. So Eric Cantor's office, before I get to that, Clinton was supposed to reaffirm those commitments. Cantor got together with Netanyahu to let Netanyahu know that he, Cantor, had his back. Now, how'd he do that? Well, Cantor's office put out a statement bragging about his pledge to Netanyahu. This is before the caca hit the fan. The statement from Cantor read as follows. This is from Cantor's office. Quote, Eric stressed that the new Republican majority will serve as a check on the administration. And what has been, up until this point, one-party rule in Washington. The readout continued. He, Cantor, made clear that the Republican majority understands the special relationship between Israel and the United States, and that the security of each nation is reliant upon the other. Now, the statement was more than that, but that's all you need to know. And as Rosenberg writes, for now, forget Cantor's ridiculous assertion that the security of Israel and the United States are reliant upon the other. No, the United States provides Israel with the security assistance to survive. It's not the other way around. Remember what Cantor said. But lay that aside, it is Cantor's statement of loyalty to Netanyahu that is the shocker. Specifically, it is his promise, Cantor's promise, that he would ensure the Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives, quote, will serve as a check, end quote, on U.S. Middle East policy. Nothing. Jesus, God. Almost immediately, Rosenberg writes, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency's bureau chief in Washington, Ron Campius, declared that Cantor's statement was extraordinary. Ron Campius wrote that he could not, quote, remember an opposition leader telling a foreign leader in a personal meeting that he would side as a policy with that foreign leader against the President of the United States. Do you understand this, truth seeker? I know you right-wingers don't. I'm not talking to you. Go back to whatever the hell you were doing, picking boogers and eating them. I'm talking to normal people. Do you understand what this is? Ron Campius, bureau chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, was clearly shocked, but he was understating the enormity of Cantor's offense. Cantor's pledge of allegiance to a foreign leader would be remarkable and deeply offensive, even if the foreign country in question were Canada or the United Kingdom, our two closest allies with whom we have few policy differences. The United States has major policy differences with Israel and has had them for decades, most notably over settlements, the occupied West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, on and on. Israel is also the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world, which means that the President of the United States has every right to express those differences firmly and clearly. On the other hand, no American official like Cantor, by any stretch of the imagination, has the right to tell the government of Israel or any foreign government that he stands with the foreign leader against his own president. It's one thing to oppose particular U.S. policies. It's quite another to tell a foreign leader, I'm with you, not my president. Let me pause and inject this. Son of a bitch! Now, have you seen this reported anywhere on the news that the soon-to-be House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has committed, by any definition, an act of treason against the United States? Should he be taken out and shot? No, he shouldn't. Should he be censured? He should have his ass kicked out of the U.S. House. Just gone. The prima facie evidence are his own words. And what will happen to Eric Cantor? Nothing. Nothing. Now, there's more on this story, but I want you to think about this during the break. The soon-to-be House Majority Leader made a pledge of allegiance to a foreign leader against his own president. Think about that.
Listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
25 before the hour. So Eric Cantor's first act as the presumptive House Majority Leader in the Congress that's going to convene in January, his first act is an act of treason against the United States. Eric Cantor put a statement out saying that he would see that the Republican majority will serve as a check on the Obama administration, where it concerns any kind of disagreement as to satisfying all the needs of Israel. Now, Hillary Clinton, of course, has done everything she possibly could to enable the state of Israel to continue with these illegal settlements. She got them to stop for a couple of weeks by giving them, promises of billions of dollars worth of jet planes or something. This is the way the United States operates with Israel. And again, at one point there may have been some sort of strategic value in being so one-sided, but as ye sow, so all also shall you reap. When you look at what we have reaped in terms of death and destruction on this planet, ours and the countries we've invaded, as a direct result of this unqualified support for the state of Israel for the past 60 years, you've got to wonder, I wonder, if it has been worth it. Israel is as close to an apartheid state as can be, and not really be South Africa. Some would argue that the former South Africa. Some would argue that it is already an apartheid state. It is not a democracy by any stretch of the imagination. I'm starting to get off topic. I want to get back to Eric Cantor. He made the assertion that he will operate in opposition to the leader of his country in favor of the leader of a foreign country, Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, as M.J. Rosenberg, writing at MediaMatters.org, points out, of course, Cantor was just being honest. Although he does oppose virtually all of Obama's policies, he's a Republican, and that's what Republicans do, Cantor supports 100% of Israel's policies. Now, think about that. think about it. To oppose 100% of what the leader of your own country proposes. And to support 100% of what the leader of a foreign country proposes in matters that, not exclusively, but certainly including those matters that are in direct opposition geopolitically to your own country. What do you call that person? I call him a traitor. An absolute, if we're going to play this game of patriotism, then Eric Cantor is a traitor. Now, I happen to believe that patriotism is a road down which, once you travel there, you're committing suicide. But that's for a different discussion. So here's Eric Cantor. Continuing what M.J. Rosenberg is writing at Media Matters, and although an extreme partisan domestically, when it comes to Israel, Cantor supports whichever government is in power. If it's the Likud, which is the far right in Israel, if it's the Labor, which is the not so far right, if it is a party that wants to seriously work with Palestinians, although I don't think there has been that party in power. But no matter what, Eric Cantor supports the government of Israel. Eric Cantor does not support the government of the United States. Now, what do you call that? What is that? Somebody answer for me so that I don't have to deal with the avalanche of crappy-ass email comes, oh, you're a goddamn anti-Semite. What do you call that? What Eric Cantor is doing. Cantor believes in the right to criticize this government, just not that one. And Rosenberg goes on, Cantor's mistake was not telling Prime Minister Netanyahu what everyone knows in this country is true anyway, that he, Cantor, will do anything to hobble or defeat Obama and everything to enable Netanyahu. Everybody knows that. That wasn't his mistake. The mistake that Eric Cantor made was in telling the world what he said. He put it up on his website. He bragged about it. As M.J. Rosenberg says, this is the classic Washington definition of a gaffe. Inadvertently speaking an inconvenient truth. And that's what Eric Cantor did. I will not support my government. I will support yours. I will do everything in my power as the House Majority Leader, and I will bring all the Republican caucus with me on this to defeat any kind of attempt by the Obama administration to do anything in the Middle East other than what you, Mr. Netanyahu, wants. What do you call that? I call it treason. Rosenberg goes on, in this case, the gaffe produced a firestorm. And this is where I consider the possibility, Rosenberg writes, that Cantor simply doesn't understand what he's doing. After all, he has been an AIPAC cutout since he first was elected to office. He's been to more AIPAC meetings, that's the American-Israel Political Action Committee. That's the very powerful Washington lobbying group that can and does threaten members of Congress, Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, that if that member does not support Israel without qualification, AIPAC will do everything in its power to see that that member of Congress is defeated in the next election. Cantor has been to more AIPAC meetings than he can probably count, and he should have figured out by now that the lobby is extremely obsessively careful to always emphasize loyalty to the United States while simultaneously endorsing Israeli policies that undermine our foreign policy objectives. That's what AIPAC does. Cantor knows that. AIPAC officials never, ever say that when push comes to shove, their loyalty is with Israel and not the United States, even though that is, I will add to what Rosenberg writes, that is the case. In fact, Rosenberg writes, the accusation that this is the case is the charge AIPAC hates the most, that they are more loyal to the objectives of Israel than those of the United States. That is a bottom line truth about AIPAC. They just don't want to admit it. And they don't want people to be aware, because they understand, the members of AIPAC understand how goddamn ignorant we are in this country. Politically, domestically, we don't have a clue. On a geopolitical level, I think my daughter Molly, who's in first grade, knows more than the average adult American. Okay, that's pushing it, but you know what I mean. AIPAC officials never say that when push comes to shove, their loyalty is with Israel and not the United States. Cantor has declared that. Cantor has now declared it. The soon-to-be majority leader came right out and said it. Israel, right or wrong, Israel. The U.S. can go screw itself. Israel, right or wrong. Rosenberg goes on, it took a few days for Cantor to understand how utterly offensive his statement was. He might have heard from a few Tea Party types who, say what you will about them, tend to take their patriotism seriously. So today, which would be yesterday, Cantor explained he was misunderstood. His inconvenient truth, his gaffe, was replaced by a laughable untruth. This is how the Washington Post Dana Milbank reports it. Quote, Brad Dayspring, Cantor's press guy, tells me Cantor's promise that the Republican majority would, quote, serve as a check on the administration, end quote, was, quote, not in relation to U.S.-Israel relations at all. Oh, no! Dana Milbank, who I believe is also Jewish, then writes, so Cantor's pledge to stand with Netanyahu against Obama was, quote, not in relation to U.S.-Israel relations, end quote. Despite the context of Cantor's statement just before Netanyahu's meeting with Clinton and the fact that the person he was talking to was the Prime Minister of Israel. So, Rosenberg asks, what was Cantor's pledge in relation to then? Was it in relation to either repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell or the Bush tax cut for millionaires? Maybe it was about farm subsidies. Come on, Eric. Don't make us laugh. It is eminently clear what you said and what you meant, and this time we will take you at your word. M.J. Rosenberg writing at Media Matters. Well, take me at my word. Eric Cantor, a member of the government of the United States, soon to be the majority leader, has committed a blatant, wide-open act of treason against the United States. What is anybody going to do about it? Huh? We'll be back.
Short to listen to right-wing radio, here's Mike Malone.
You know, again, it's one thing to have a certain mindset about an issue of U.S. foreign policy. I don't think there's any doubt how the support for Israel has become encased in U.S. foreign policy. I don't foresee a time when any president, Democrat or Republican, would ever break the chain that binds us to Israel. I think that is a gross mistake. I understand the reasons for that support early on, back in the late 40s when the United Nations made the declaration. But to continue a policy that has involved us now that the so-called Cold War is over, the one between us and the Soviet Union, although a new Cold War is beginning between us and China, so the Jewish question will not come up between the United States and China. It'll be something else, probably the question of the Uyghurs or some other benighted minority. But the issue of Israel, the United States has never been fair in its treatment, ever, of the Palestinians, under any circumstances, no way, no how. And the propaganda in this country, in other words, the groupthink that has prevailed in this country, is that Israel is totally innocent in all of these matters, and that the Palestinians are totally guilty in all of these matters. That has been the propaganda policy of every single administration since the establishment of the State of Israel. A couple of people tried to fight against it. George Herbert Walker Bush did not go along with that. And some people will make the case that that's the reason he was defeated for a second term. I think Harry Truman was in office when the state was established, but he had some reservations about it. So it has been the policy of the United States government to support, no matter what they did, to support the Israelis. And it has been the policy of the United States to be in opposition to, no matter what they did, the Palestinian people. One of the demands that was put out by Osama bin Laden before the attack on this country, if you want to believe the official story, was for the United States to get his ass out of the lands that contain the holy places of Islam, i.e. get its military presence out of Saudi Arabia, which George Bush did after the threat. And the second thing was to stop supporting the oppressors in the Middle East, i.e. the Israelis, where it concerned the Palestinians, which no president would ever have the courage to do, ever. We are stuck. Israel is an albatross around the neck of this country, and it will remain so forever. That's one of the reasons, until there's some cataclysmic event. And that's one of the reasons why I hate to get to the topic. I really do, because nothing is going to change. That is an issue that will never change. And it means a continuing problem, and that's putting it mildly, for the U.S. in our negotiations with everybody in it, from Syria all the way to the Islamic the Islamic provinces, dominating provinces, where Islam dominates in China. That whole wide swath of nation after nation after nation, not to mention sympathizers to the Palestinian situation around the globe. This is a problem that is not resolvable. Because it would take a declaration by the United States, okay, we have supported this country for 60 years. We have put ourselves in countless wars because of this country. We have sided with this country even when it is against ethical conduct, moral conduct, honest conduct. We're not going to do it anymore. We are withdrawing. We're going to take a position of neutrality. That will never happen. Tim from L.A. writes, ever thought of this, Mike? Eric Cantor's actions may very well have constituted a felony under the Logan Act. The Logan Act prohibits anyone, quote, any American without authority of the United States, official authority from the executive branch, to communicate with a foreign government, to influence that government's behavior on any disputes with the United States, end quote. Well, I'm sure that Cantor's conduct in this does constitute a violation of the Logan Act. But beyond that, it's purely and simply, by just about any definition I can think of, it's an act of treason against the United States. Now, these goddamn teabaggers and these goddamn right-wing Republicans who insist, well, we're going to impeach Obama once we're in power because he's committing treason. Where are you scum-eating thugs about this issue? Huh? Where are you? The soon-to-be majority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives has declared his allegiance to a foreign power above that of the United States. So I'll just ask it again. Where are you, people? Where's your reaction? What do you got to say about this? We'll be back after the break. Seven past the hour. This is the Molloy program. As this freshman class of thugs and morons and halfwits and people who are going to reduce government gather in Washington to be educated by someone like Dick Armey. Does nobody else see the irony in that? So many of these teabagger types, which constitute the majority of Republicans in this freshman class, and frankly, and this is true, this is not the sour grapes story as told by Aesop, but I am thrilled with the number of Democrats who had their asses kicked, because they were blue dog Democrats to begin with, which means they weren't really Democrats, they were just Republican light. And as we've said on this program, and people a lot smarter than me have said over and over and over again, if you're going to be a Republican, have the nerve to be a Republican. Like here in Georgia, after the election, here within the state, we had a bunch of so-called Democrats immediately switch parties. This happens. This has happened with alarming regularity in the state of Georgia, to the point where it is almost totally controlled now by one party. If that's not totalitarianism, somebody please tell me what it is. Totalitarianism, total, T-O-T-A-L, total, total, total. I sound like Glenn Beck. I sound like the suicider, Glenn Beck. See, total, that word is right there. Can you believe that? Total. Totalitarianism. The word total is the first five letters in the word totalitarian. Jesus Christ. I can understand how easy it is to be nuts. Huh?
T is for Trotsky.
T is for Trotsky. Of course, Trotsky was a good one. He was one of the good ones.
That's why, is for oligarchy.
That's why he got a hatchet in his head in Mexico. But I digress. So many of these new Republicans who've never held office before are learning the ways of Washington from the guy who runs FreedomWorks, a teabag front organization, and the guy who runs FreedomWorks, the front man, of the Front Organization. The organization is really funded by the Koch brothers and all these other billionaires who, for sport, want to see if they can use their money to turn the country totally fascist. This is what the billionaires have always done in this country. You can go back to, the turn of the century before the last one. Same thing. These evil snake bastards are always there. They're always there. Capitalism always breeds fascism at some point. Always. So Dick Armey is educating these uneducable freaks who are soon going to run your government. And again, if nobody sees the irony of that, here is this slimy Dick Armey, who is the ultimate insider, trying to educate the freshman class of Republicans who ran as outsiders. And they are literally outside the Washington establishment. But if anyone wants to pretend that Dick Armey is, then let's all pretend that I am Tsar Nicholas and I'm about to be taken off to the woods and be executed. That makes as much sense. One of the people in the freshman class is a doctor, an anesthesiologist from Maryland. And the stunning part of this to me, he was elected to Congress on an anti-Obamacare platform. That's how he got, you know, he's a physician, he's a doctor, anesthesiologist. And according to Glenn Thrush, writing up Politico.com, he was at a freshman orientation session on Monday, yesterday. And he threw the meeting into chaos when he stood up and demanded to know why his government-subsidized health care plan takes a month to kick in. Andy Harris is his name. He's an anesthesiologist who defeated freshman Democrat Frank Kratoval on Maryland's Eastern Shore. And Republican Andy Harris, the anesthesiologist, reacted incredulously when informed that federal law mandated that his government-subsidized health care policy would take effect on February 1st, 2011, 28 days after his January 3rd swearing in. Okay? So what happened? Well, according to a congressional staffer, Republican, who was in the room, quote, he stood up and asked the two ladies who were answering questions why it had to take so long, what he would do without 28 days of health care. End quote. The benefits session, that's why he was there, to find out about the benefits he was now going to get at public expense, this rotten son of a bitch. The benefits session, held behind closed doors, of course, drew about 250 freshman members, staffers, family members, to the Capitol Visitor Center Auditorium Monday morning. According to the Republican aide who was there, Andy Harris, then asked if he could purchase insurance from the government to cover the gap. Said the aide, who was struck by the similarity to Harris's request and the public option that he had denounced when he was running for office as a gateway to socialized medicine. And here this rancid bastard is. First thing, where's my health care? Another one of these right-wing pigs who ran on a platform against health care for everybody else, but let his ass get up there. Where's my health care? What? I don't get it until February 1st? Andy Harris is a Maryland state senator who works at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and several hospitals on the Eastern Shore. He also told his audience, quote, this is the only employer I've ever worked for where you don't get coverage the first day you're employed. Oh, my God. Don't you just want to... Under the COBRA law, poor millionaire Mr. Harris can pay a premium to extend his current health insurance an additional month. Now, if he was a state legislator back in Maryland, in addition to being an anesthesiologist, you know that he has been on the public tit for how long where it concerns his health care. Because I don't think the state of Maryland is different from any state legislature. They take care of their own. Health care, you got it. But only for us here in the group. So Harris, you know, the Cobra Law, when you lose your job, for whatever reason, you can continue the insurance you had provided by your employer if you want to pay pretty much what the employer was paying for your insurance. But Andy Harris said, oh, no. Oh, no. And he said, I'm not being hypocritical. I'm just pointing out the inefficiency of government-run health care. I'll be goddamned. I'm not being hypocritical. He runs to get elected against public health care, against these insurance plans, against Obamacare that makes it easier for people to get insurance. And when he finds out there's going to be a 28-day gap, he doesn't want to pay the COBRA rate like normal Americans do. And he can't understand why he can't get on the public boob immediately. Where's my health care? What do you call that? Huh? Criminal hypocrisy? But this is the way Republicans are. This is this guy's defining moment. And he defines with this every single member of this freshman class of Republicans. Every one of these snakes. So I say turn them loose. Let these sons of bitches go. Let them run the government. Let's have 2 years of this and see where the country is at the end of 2 years. Let's just do it. I'm a rumor, I'm a doubt, I'm a lie. But you wouldn't stand near me if you didn't want to die. Everything you know is wrong. There's a verse missing out of this song. Everything you know is wrong. Did I mention our second sponsor tonight? Hour two tonight is sponsored by Glenn in the United Kingdom. And his message is for Rose in the United Kingdom. Here is Glenn's message. Mike Malloy sends you the best wishes and fully understands how much you detest the ghastly Tory David Cameron and his traitorous running dog Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg, that you despise fascists and hate teabaggers. As you said, Rose, we have to resist these filthy capitalists because we know from our Victorian history just what these monsters consider good enough for us common folk. All my love forever, Glenn in the UK. And that's for Rose in the UK. And Glenn is the sponsor of our second hour tonight. If you want to know what we're doing here, go to MikeMalloy.com and up on the, what do you call that bar? Toolbar, you'll see topic. You'll see sponsors or sponsor. Click and it will all come clear for you. Once again, from Glenn in the UK to Rose in the UK. Mike Malloy sends you the best wishes and fully understands how much you detest the ghastly Tory David Cameron and his traitorous running dog Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg, that you despise fascists and hate teabaggers. As you said, Rose, we have to resist these filthy capitalists because we know from our Victorian history just what these monsters consider good enough for us common folk. All my love forever, Glenn in the UK. Good on you, Glenn. That's a good message. Back to this Republican freak, Andy Harris, an anesthesiologist who has been in state government in Maryland and defeated freshman Democrat Frank Kratovil, and is in the freshman class in Washington right now. And he's all pissed off because he has to wait 28 days for his taxpayer-subsidized health care. Can you believe this scum? Can you believe them? And this means, of course, he'll have free health care for the rest of his life. Okay, maybe not. I don't know. I don't even know. Is it free or a very minimal amount of money that the taxpayers pay for? Anyway, during the campaign, this hypocritical bastard, Harris, hammered his Democratic opponent, Kratovil, on health care. Throughout, according to Glenn Thrush at Politico, throughout a bitter fall campaign, despite the fact that the blue dog Democrat, Kratovil, voted twice against the reform package backed by Nancy Pelosi and House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. Harris, the new representative from Maryland's Eastern Shore, he said in an October 30th statement before the election, this hypocritical bastard said, quote, although he voted against Obamacare, Mr. Kratovil refuses to commit to its repeal. Dr. Harris understands that the Obama-Pelosi-Hoyer agenda threatens to pull the plug on America's long-term health. In Washington, I will never vote to raise taxes. I will fight to repeal health care reform, and I will work to balance the budget. And the first thing this snake bastard does when he gets to Washington, he wants to know, where is his government-subsidized health care plan that takes a month to kick in? I mean, Jesus, is this being reported? It's being reported at Politico, but mainstream media, media covering this story, covering the one about the act of complete treason by the soon-to-be House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor? Huh? Anybody carry this stuff? Anybody give a damn about these cockroaches that are destroying the country, this country? Huh? Anybody? Apparently not. Apparently not. What a sad state of affairs, right? All right, when we come back, I have a quote from the Tao Te Ching that is pertinent to an email that it came with. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 25 before the hour. You knocked me out off my feet. You're right. Yeah, this is kind of new for us, our sponsorships. This hour is sponsored by or brought to you by Glenn in the U.K., who has a message for Rose in the U.K., the message being Mike Molloy sends you the best wishes and fully understands how much you detest the ghastly Tory David Cameron and his traitorous running mate, or his traitorous running dog, Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg. That you despise fascists and hate teabaggers. As you said, Rose, we have to resist these filthy capitalists because we know from our Victorian history just what these monsters consider good enough for us common folk. All my love forever, Glenn in the UK. And if you want to know what this is all about, like I said, go to MikeMolloy.com and on the toolbar click on sponsors and behold. Quick email from Paul. Mike, you do your country service by pointing out that Eric Cantor is acting on behalf of a foreign government. He has said he would place the imperatives of that government before the interests of our country and his unquestioning support of everything that the Israeli government does, apartheid policies and all. I do take issue, however, with your categorizing what he is doing as treason. For better or worse, treason is defined in the Constitution as, quote, only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort, end quote. As Israel is technically not an enemy of the United States, what Cantor is doing is technically not treason. All that said, keep up the good work. You're on a roll tonight with your exposure of the selfish, hypocritical, and anti-American ways of our new rulers. Regards, Paul. I'll certainly accept that. I think sometimes when I use these terms, and I realize I sometimes throw terms around real loosely, and I'm glad for the correction. To me, treason is putting the interests of another country before your own. Although, on the other hand, people could then make the argument, I guess, and probably in a more valid way, that what Jane Fonda did with her visit to Hanoi back in the bad old days of the of our invasion and occupation and murder in Vietnam was an act of treason. But I wouldn't think so, because it was an undeclared war. We were the invader. Vietnam had done nothing to us. Does that sound familiar? Oh, well, I don't want to get that deeply into it. Anyway, thanks, Paul. Hello, Mike. The following is an excerpt from a book written over 2,500 years ago by Lao Tzu called The Tao Te Ching. It's from chapter 22, quote, yield and overcome, bend and be straight, empty and be full, wear out and be new, have little and gain, have much and be confused. I began thinking about this chapter quite a bit the other day, especially as I hear more and more people say things like, we need to simplify our message, or we need short, catchy slogans in order to win elections. It seems these days the truth just takes too much effort. In this country, the vast majority of people do not take to scholarship for learning. Instead, they learn by experience. This does not necessarily mean the vast majority of people are stupid. I've known plenty of intelligent people in my lifetime who could not add 2 + 2, but could rebuild an engine like no one's business. I've known people who could barely read, yet get them into a machine shop and they could turn out precision parts from raw lumps of metal within thousandths of an inch. Thanks to the degradation of our public school system, done on purpose by our corporate overlords in order to turn us into good consumers, our society has plunged even further into ignorance, with a seeming inability to grasp complex thought. Conservatives, teabaggers, Fox, and Republicans prey on this ignorance with their election sloganeering. They're able to convince Americans to vote against their best interests with well-crafted propaganda and simple messages like tax cuts. This got me thinking. Since the only way the vast majority of people in this country learn is by experience, it's going to take a massive, painful, long-term experience in order to teach Americans the hard lessons they are so desperately in need of learning. The last time in recent history Americans learned the hard lesson was the Great Depression. It's not necessarily that Americans were smarter back then or more aware, although perhaps that argument could be made, but it's more that the vast majority of Americans experienced severe economic trauma and pain through no fault of their own. By experience, they learned the dangers of capitalism and fascism. They learned about how the wealthy elite in this country need to be kept in check and watched carefully. Out of this experience, Americans grew to appreciate labor. We also had a 91% top tax rate on the wealthy elite. 40% of tax revenue came from corporations. We had tariffs in place in order to protect American manufacturing. War profiteering was illegal. And there's this from Wikipedia, quote, in April 1944, 4 months into a nationwide strike by the company's 12,000 workers, U.S. Army troops seized the Chicago offices of Montgomery Ward and Company. Montgomery Ward refused to comply with a War Labor Board order to recognize the unions and institute the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. 8 months later, with Montgomery Ward continuing to refuse to recognize the unions, President Roosevelt issued an executive order seizing all of Montgomery Ward's property nationwide, citing the War Labor Disputes Act, as well as his power under the Constitution as Commander-in-Chief, end quote. All this value we once had for American labor was born out of a learning experience by those who lived through the Great Depression. It was not taught by scholarship. It was not brought about by intelligent discourse or high-minded debate or deliberating on facts. Politically, much was brought about by FDR, but only because the vast majority of Americans had his back. My point is that I recently reached the conclusion that in order for America to move forward, I fear we once again need to learn this hard lesson. What we had learned by experience through the Great Depression has passed out of collective memory. No amount of scholarship, debate, or dialogue is going to convince the majority of Americans of this lesson. Only experience can reach them, and some people you just can't reach. So, to that end, my suggestion is that we begin pushing for even more tax cuts. In fact, why have any taxes at all? Why have any regulations at all? Why even have a government? Why shouldn't each state just be its own country? Why should the government provide any services? People should learn to pick themselves up by their bootstraps and stand on their own 2 feet, as conservatives are so fond of saying. And my further point is that perhaps it's time for us to employ some Aikido and use the momentum garnered by the teabagger movement against them. They say they want lower taxes. I say let's have no taxes. They say they want smaller government. I say why have government at all? They say they want states' rights. I say why not let states be their own countries? Now, you and I know what the end result of all this would be. There would be a huge crash in our economy and a devolution of our society. The experience would spread to everyone from the most high-minded intellectual to the most ignorant teabagger among us. But eventually, those hard lessons would once again be learned by everyone, and then perhaps we could start to rebuild our country from the smoldering ashes teabagger-style corporatism will surely leave behind. Joe in Temecula, California. That's kind of what I was saying before the election, in extremis, for sure. And the problem, I think the most obvious problem with that, although I certainly agree in principle with what Joe is writing about, but I think all of us can see the immediate problem. There is the idea of breaking something beyond the point which it can be either reconstructed or even constructed anew. And, you know, I've had to give this thought, too, because, like I said, I certainly my sympathies lie with what Joe was saying. I would think that the new model would be social democracy. Democratic socialism. Ooh! You know, that certainly allowed for entrepreneurship and small businesses and family farms and little manufacturing plants. You know, what these teabaggers always talk about when they say they want to go back to the way it was. Well, that's the way it was, you morons. And certain major industries in this country should be nationalized. permanently and forever. But I don't think that's going to happen, given Joe's formula or the one that I would be sympathetic to. You can smash something, you know, smash the state, which is an anarchist slogan. And it has its, it has its plus side in a way, except if the smashing is done thoroughly and completely, upon what would a new state or whatever takes its place be built? Anarchy might be a good temporary activity, but I don't think it's I don't think it computes where it concerns governance, because it's the opposite of governance. Therefore, it doesn't compute. Okay, I'm getting in over my head. All right, I'll leave this alone. But Joe and Temecula, to a lesser degree than you're suggesting, that's been my suggestion. Let the bastards have it. Let America see what it's like to be governed by a bunch of clowns. We'll be right back.
I don't want. History. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world.
Where is the outrage? Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. And once again, this hour has been sponsored by Glenn in the UK. His message is for Rose in the UK. To wit, Mike Malloy sends you the best wishes and fully understands how much you detest the ghastly Tory David Cameron and his traitorous running dog Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg, and that you despise fascists and hate teabaggers. As you said, Rose, we have to resist these filthy capitalists because we know from our Victorian history just what these monsters consider good enough for us common folk. All my love forever, Glenn in the UK. I feel like Match.com for some reason. Lisa Murkowski was interviewed with CBS's Katie Couric the other day. I'm not sure when it happened, recently. Monday, I guess. And even given, you know, this is another inconvenient truth, even given the animosity that exists between the Murkowski family, her father is the former governor of Alaska, Lisa's father, and Sarah Palin was the part-time governor, the two-year governor, until she decided to quit. To quit. To goddamn quit. You get elected governor of a state. In the middle of it, you see, well, there's more money over there. I can go over there. I'll go make a lot of money. You know, I can see money from my front porch. That makes me a millionaire. Well, in her case, it did. So she quits her job. Quits her job, right? In an interview with CBS's Katie Couric, Murkowski said that Sarah Palin lacks, quote, the intellectual curiosity, end quote, to be president. That's not all she lacks, Lisa. Murkowski also said Palin does not have the, quote, leadership qualities, end quote, to be commander-in-chief. Oh, really? What else, Lisa? Next thing you know, you're going to be telling us water is wet. And there's this thing called gravity. Murkowski went on Katie Couric's little toy news show, quote, you know, she was my governor for 2 years, just about 2 years there, and I don't think that she enjoyed governing. I don't think she liked to get down into the policy, end quote. Murkowski said she would prefer a candidate who, quote, goes to bed at night, wakes up in the morning thinking about how we're going to deal with important issues, end quote. Murkowski, bless her heart, is defeating the Nazi. the literal, real, true, brown shirt Nazi sympathizer, Joe Miller. She is beating his ass. I guess, you know, this might be an example. You know, the people of Delaware sat home, the Republicans did, and they let this ditz, what was her name? O'Donnell, Catherine? Catherine O'Donnell? Christine O'Donnell become the Republican Party nominee for the Senate. And as a result, that Senate seat is now owned for the next 6 years by a Democrat. Way to go, dumbasses. And it could have been the seat, it could have stayed or could have been in the hands of the Republican who was running, Castle. But no! But at the last minute, you see, the people came out of the ether and realized what a dunce O'Donnell was. Well, Alaska, you know, they have a primary up there, and the psycho Sarah Palin hops aboard her little private jet now and slides into Alaska and tells people to vote for Joe Miller. He's there. And so the people did. And then after he has won the Republican nomination, it becomes very clear to the people of Alaska that vote what they have done. They have nominated, and for a moment it looks like he was going to become a senator, they have nominated for the Senate a full-blown American Nazi. An American fascist of the highest order who has no problem employing soldiers to stop reporters from asking him questions. Okay? So Murkowski, for whatever reason, didn't want to be unemployed, believed in keeping the real fascists out of government. I don't know what her reason was, but she ran as a write-in candidate, and the people of Alaska who vote came out of their stupor and realized what they had done and immediately undid it. And it appears that Murkowski is going to win as the first time since, I think, Strom Thurmond in 1950-something, 54, Strom Thurmond, this white crazy bastard from South Carolina who ran as a Dixiecrat write-in candidate. I believe this is how it worked out, and he got himself elected to the U.S. Senate. That's the last time it's happened where a write-in candidate has been elected to the U.S. Senate, and it appears that Murkowski is going to pull this off, which is a good thing. I think the people of Alaska understand how close they came to having a National Socialist, a Nazi, representing their state. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen on a national scale here in the United States. We're going to have a number of years with these little piglets squealing around Washington, D.C., and then the American people are going to come out of the ether and say, oh, my God. All right, we have a break here. We'll be back. Stick around. Coming up this next hour, I'm going off on one of my anti-religion rants. In support of the American Humanist Association. You're going to love this. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. back, welcome back, welcome back. And to the Mike Malloy program, it is 7 past the hour. And here in hour three of tonight's program, our sponsor is George. And George writes, "Happy wedding anniversary to my beautiful wife, Marianne, for the best 25 years of my life. Love, George." Happy wedding anniversary to my beautiful wife, Marianne, for the best 25 years of my life. Love, George. I think I'm going to cry. Do you cry at weddings? I always cry at weddings. I cannot help myself.
Only yours.
Yeah, you know, no, not just mine. Yeah, there was a reason I cried at mine. You know, the person running the video cam.
I was at one of them.
Yeah, you were at one of my weddings, weren't you? No, I always cry at weddings. I cannot, as soon as I walk into wherever the wedding is going to take place, I start to tear up. And when they do that, is that Bach, Brahms? What's the wedding march? What is that? Once they start that, that's it. Here comes the bra. Oh, my God, look. Oh, if you only knew what you got ahead of you. Run! Turn around and run! No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Anyway, George sponsors this third hour tonight. Happy wedding anniversary to my beautiful wife, Marianne, for the best 25 years of my life. Love, George. That is sweet beyond words. I love that. All right. As promised, we're going to try to launch you into the Christmas season here. There's only about, 6 weeks to go? 5 and a half? And the best way to launch you into the Christmas season, to let you know that a humanist organization, one of the largest humanist organizations, the American Humanist Association, one of the largest in America, has launched an ad campaign critical of religious scripture. Now, I think this is great. I really do. Yeah, I'm an atheist. I don't beat the drum for it, except when asked. Wait a minute. I guess I do go after religion on this program, but only in the context of reaction. Reaction. When I see yet another article of some crazed Christian group wanting to replace science with religious idolatry and superstition in public schools, I freak. I really do. I've no problem if a religious organization wants to teach religious terrorism, persecution, lies, deceit, and superstition in their classrooms, go ahead, I guess. You know, that's according to the official story, that's how we were attacked on September 11, 2001, religious fanatics. And it doesn't make any difference which religion. They're religious fanatics. I mean, you know, okay, there I go. See, getting up on that soapbox. But anyway, a national multimedia ad campaign, the largest and most extensive ever, by a godless organization, launched a week ago today, last Tuesday. It included a commercial on NBC's Dateline last Friday, as well as other television ads that directly challenge biblical morality and fundamentalist Christianity. Well, I think this is great. Is religion so sacrosanct that it can't survive in the marketplace of ideas? Isn't that what the right-wingers are always talking about, the marketplace of ideas? There has been a ethos, if that's the right word, of silence in this country where it concerns challenging religion. It's never done, especially not Christianity. Oh, you're challenging the Baptists, the Methodists, the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, the Christians? You're challenging the Catholic Church? Of course, the Catholic Church always seems immune, don't they? No matter what they do, no matter what crimes against humanity are committed by the Catholic Church, it escapes century after century after century. It's in its third millennium now, and it escapes total and complete condemnation no matter what it does. No matter what the Church of Rome does. And its offspring, Protestantism, no matter what they do, they escape criticism. You can look at the history, if you are so inclined, of actions taken in the name of the church's God and in the name of the church's main avatar, and you will see a path of blood, gore, destruction, death, horror, terror that stretches back over centuries. But we don't talk about it. No. Think of the little baby Jesus. Think of the Virgin Mary. We don't talk about any challenge to religion in this country. It's just not allowed. To the point that we have people, or had people running for Senate in this last election. I'm thinking of Christine O'Donnell right now, who challenges the idea that the First Amendment makes a very clear representation of the separation of church and state. Very clear. There's no ambiguity about it. It's very clear. But poor Christine O'Donnell, like so many misguided religious believers, well, where does it say that specifically? Separation of church and state. Doesn't say that. No. I guess it doesn't. And 2 plus 2 equals 4 doesn't say 2 what plus 2 what equals 4 what. So that's invalid too, right? The ads that are coming out from the American Humanist Association juxtapose humanist quotes with passages from religious texts, including the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. The ads then ask the audience to, quote, consider humanism. And that's the gist of the campaign. Consider humanism. Why not? Why are humanists or so-called non-believers able to immerse themselves in religious study to find out what in the hell these people are talking about and come out unscathed? On the other hand, believers seem incapable, certainly not interested, but seem incapable of immersing themselves into atheistic philosophy and returning unscathed. They can't do it. Why is that? Well, we all know the answer. The famous dictum, give me a child till he's 4, 6, whatever, and I'll give you a Catholic for life. That applies not just to Catholicism, of course. It applies to any religion, because religion is injected into young minds and young consciousnesses with that most motivating of human emotions, terror. Absolute terror. You don't believe this way, little Johnny, little Susie, and your immortal soul will burn forever. Now, the average 5 or 6 year old, what's a kid going to say at that point? No, it won't. So it is massively unfair, a massive case of absolute corruptive brainwashing to do this to a child. To take any child from prior to the age of reason, prior to the ability to even form coherent thoughts, and junk this stuff into the kid's brain, unconscious, subconscious, conscious, ultra-conscious, neo-ultra-consciousness. He said that the child is saturated. Believe this way or mommy and daddy will perish in hell, and so will you. Does that seem fair to you? We'll be right back.
Ties and socks. My kids are never happy with what's under the tree. Soon they'll understand Christmas sucks. Whoa, every freaking year Christmas sucks. Christmas sucks. Christmas sucks.
Hey!
Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Please don't misunderstand. I love the holiday season, but the holiday I tend to associate with this time of year is the ancient holiday that was twisted into a celebration of the birth of the Christian avatar. And that holiday, of course, was winter solstice. And it is an ancient, deeply embedded holiday. That's why it was so easy for the Romans to convert people to this new superimposed belief that was based in insanity, whereas the winter solstice was based in physical, a cosmic reality. I mean, there is a big difference. The superstition around the winter solstice was as entertaining, if not more so, than the superstition around the Mass of Christ. But at least the winter solstice had somewhere embedded in it the movement, planetary movement, irrefutable physical laws. And it was overlaid, of course, with the mysticism that the ancients were unable to otherwise explain. So that, to me, is a winter holiday. If you celebrate, whatever you celebrate, celebrate it. But just keep in mind, if you do something around 25th of December, you are, in fact, acknowledging a holiday that precedes the religious beliefs by, I don't know, pick a number, millennia? Hundreds of years? Thousands? Who knows? Anyway, back to this this humanist organization. The American Humanist Association have launched this advertising campaign, Critical of Religious Scripture. Now, it is not, they don't go after Christmas or any of the religious holidays. They're just talking in general. Why is it not acceptable in this country to challenge openly and head on religious belief systems? You know, why? In a more suppressed era, we just kept all the stuff to ourselves. Can you imagine if you're over a certain age? I realize Kennedy had to make his pitch to the Christian fundamentalists in this country that if he were elected president, the Pope would not rule America. Ooh, the Christian fundamentalists were so afraid of that one. I mean, the Protestants. Oh, wait a minute. This is way back in the late 50s. Kennedy had to approach these Southern Protestant preachers, say, "No, I will not let the country be run by a papal authority." But throughout our recent history, you know, the idea of somebody spouting off about, "Well, I prayed about going to war. God told me to invade Iraq." I mean, that person would have been dubbed insane. Completely mad. If someone felt that they were told to invade this country or kill that person, they kept it to themselves. Or if someone had an idea, "I made my way through the crisis by getting down on my knees and praying to God, and God answered me every single night. We had long conversations." Okay, all right, but people kept that to themselves. This kind of self-hypnotic Scientology kind of horse crap. You know what I'm saying? Where was I? The American Humanist Association are putting out these ads that ask the viewer of the ad to consider humanism. What they do, they pair secular comments with examples from religious texts. Here's an example. This is from the Bible. Quote, "A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She must be silent." Now, that, of course, that comes from 1 Timothy chapter 2, and it was written by, wasn't it, Paul's epistles to various tribes around the time of the establishment of Christianity, and it was very clear. Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are all horrifically suppressive religions where it concerns women. We all know that. Now, the humanist take on this, and they quote Robert Ingersoll in a letter dated April 13th, 1878, quote, "The rights of men and women should be equal and sacred. Marriage should be a perfect partnership, end quote. Now here's another pairing from the Bible. The people of Samaria must bear their guilt because they have rebelled against their God. They will fall by the sword. Their little ones will be dashed to the ground. Their pregnant women ripped open. Ooh. That is from Hosea 13, chapter 16. Humanism, quoting Albert Einstein in a column for the New York Times, November 9, 1930. Einstein, quote, "I cannot imagine a God who rewards and punishes the objects of his creation, whose purposes are modeled after our own. A God, in short, who is but a reflection of human frailty." Good point, Al. Good point. More on this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. We're just kidding with the music. We just, I guess because of the topic. And by the way, this hour of the Mike Malloy program is sponsored by George, who says the following. Happy wedding anniversary to my beautiful wife, Marianne. For the best 25 years of my life. Love, George.
You were married.
Happy wedding anniversary to my beautiful wife, Marianne, for the best 25 years of my life. Love, George. That's very sweet. If you wonder what we're doing here with these sponsorships, go to MikeMalloy.com, and on the main page, you'll see location bar, whatever the hell you call it, you'll see something that says sponsor. Click it, and it'll all come clear. American Humanist Association has started an ad campaign said to be the most extensive ever by a godless organization. The point of their ad is that humanist values are mainstream American values. I would take it one step further and say humanist values are mainstream global. They're by definition, they're values necessary to the development, growth, safety, security, understanding, wisdom, intellectual stimulation of humans. I mean, they say in their press release, the executive director of the American Humanist Association said, quote, "Humanist values are mainstream American values, and this campaign will help many people realize that they are already humanists and just did not know the term. Humanists believe in and value love, equality, peace, freedom, and reason. Values that are comparable to those of moderate and liberal religious people." End quote. The ads, in addition to the television ads on NBC, ads will also be displayed on cable channels. There will be print ads in major newspapers like USA Today, Seattle Times, Village Voice, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, San Francisco Chronicle, and magazines including Reason, The Progressive. Ads will appear in metro trains in D.C., on billboards near Philadelphia, and in Moscow, Idaho, and on buses in select cities. Again, quoting the executive director of the American Humanist Association, he says, quote, "We want to reach people in every corner of the United States from all walks of life to raise the flag for humanists and show others that they have more in common with us than with biblical literalists." And he goes on to say, "It's important that people recognize that a literal reading of religious texts is completely out of touch with mainstream America. Although religious texts can teach good lessons, they also advocate fear, intolerance, hate, ignorance. It's time for all modern people to stand up against conservative religion's claim on a moral monopoly," end quote. Yeah, that's very true, isn't it? So if you want more information about this, go to their website, American Humanist AmericanHumanistAssociation.org. Or, I'm sorry, let me just try it again, AmericanHumanist.org. AmericanHumanist.org. And you can see some of the video ads that they're going to be running, or the video ad they're going to be running, or have run, or whatever. But it's amazing to me that Dateline NBC even took an ad. It's amazing to me when any mainstream media outlet in this country agrees to talk about or allow advocacy for anything that is not just saturated with religious belief. Oh, well. Now, in line with this, I got an email from Tom in Joshua Tree, California, several days ago. And this is what he writes. "Mike, yesterday," he's referring to last week, "I listened to Tom Hartman interview Chris Hedges. A caller asked Hedges what he thought about atheists. Both Hartman and Hedges went nuts. You can hear it yourself on the third hour of Hartman's podcast for 9 November. To summarize, Hedges said he found all the new atheists, such as Hitchens, Dawkins, Sam Harris, Carl Sagan, and Stephen Hawking, to be obnoxious and just as strident and mindless as the religious crazies that they criticize. Then Hartman joined in and said that although he does not believe in a bearded old man that lives in the sky, he does believe in an energy force like Gaia that serves the religious experience that must be respected. It was a lesson to hear and understand how thoroughly early childhood inculcation conflates with emotions to subvert even the minds of those whom we otherwise respect and admire. Hartman essentially admits to being an atheist while decrying atheism. Then Hedges conflated the argument against a God who lives in the sky with a non-existent argument against genuine and sincere spiritual, religious, or mystical experience that most atheists actually promote as part of any well-rounded, informed, and experiential life." Hedges became livid and took the new atheist as an attack on his own person and the persons of his family and friends, whom he said exhibit sincere religious experience that must, according to Hedges, be respected. Must. Here is the inconsistency. Hedges is making a career out of blaming the left for abandoning the working class, but will not speak or write harshly or critically against institutional Christianity, or Christians in particular, who have all abandoned the teachings of Christ. It was amazing to hear. My jaw dropped. The man has reason, morals, ethics, and a good sense of political and economic justice. But his reason and analysis never applies to the beliefs that foster and propagate the lies, violence, and delusions that he castigates. What it teaches me is that these well-adjusted, well-mannered, and highly educated liberal voices are the way they are not because they have discovered and applied some quasi-mystical secret to the universe of psychological balance. It is because they are stunted by their own emotional precognitive attachments that blind them to the root and reason of all they protest. Otherwise, if they had ever looked directly into the flames of this delusion and finally understood its pernicious poisons, then they too would be as compelled with the same outrage and urgency as the rest of us. Tom in Joshua Tree, California. Tom is always challenging, don't you think? And I will say that, in terms of reading this letter on the air, I sent an email to Tom Hartman and just said, you know, I've got something here that's mildly critical of you when you interviewed Hedges, and it has to do with religion. And I'm going to read it on the air. Just wanted to give you a heads up in case you would get emails after I read it saying, Malloy tore you a new body orifice. And Hartman, as closely as you can in an email, kind of chuckled and said, ah, go for it. But out of respect to Tom, because I know Tom, and I know his positions, and I respect him. But I completely agree with what Tom in Joshua Tree, California wrote. I did not hear Hartman's program. And it shocks me about Chris Hedges. The point, I think, was that Tom in Joshua Tree, California was writing, the point of his writing was more the inability, apparently, of Chris Hedges, whose political points of view and whose ripping of the failure of liberalism to do what it's supposed to do, I find very intriguing. I read with deep interest and a lot of respect. For Hedges to be an apologist for this crazy religious, murderous, vicious insanity, to me is just, I don't know. That was definitely a shock. So I'm glad Tom and Joshua Tree sent the email. Okay. What else have I got here? Do I have anything worth talking, or should we just go ahead and end the program now? I'll tell you what, let's take a break. During the break, I'll decide if we have anything. If you come back and we're not here, it just means I said to hell with it. So go ahead, roll the dice. We might be back in a moment. I'm just kidding! It is 10 before the hour, and this hour has been brought to you by George, who writes, Happy wedding anniversary to my beautiful wife, Marianne, for the best 25 years of my life. Love, George. It's very sweet. I think it's very sweet. What else we got here? I guess I feel compelled to say something about this American Humanist Association thing and what might sound to some of you like hypocrisy, because we are making offers for the holiday season of two for one for the podcast, which takes something that normally costs $59.60 and reduces it down to about less than $30 per. That is a 1-year subscription to the podcast of this program. But I don't think it's hypocrisy at all, because we don't present this as a Christmas gift. If anything, my feelings around winter celebrations, and I love them. I absolutely love them. It has to do, I think I've gotten to the point where it has to do more with the ancient celebration around this time of year. I know I feel that way about seasonal celebrations during the rest of the year. They're just something very attractive if you open yourself up to it. I know a lot of people who listen to this program know exactly what I'm talking about. This is for the right-wingers, the religious people who listen to this program to see what Satan is saying tonight, working through the vocal cords of that terrible Mike Malloy who's going to burn in hell forever. So it's addressed to you folks who are waiting for that glorious moment when I keel over dead from a heart attack, and you know that my soul has been cast into an everlasting lake of fire. but why not? Why not celebrate the seasonal changes, the rhythms of life, rather than the threats of death? That's the thing, I guess, that is so off-putting to me. It became off-putting when I got older and started to realize what religion really, truly was, the foundation of it, the basis of it, its horrible, horrible impact on human life over the, recorded and unrecorded history, as far as I know, from... like most of you who have gotten a liberal arts education, I took a couple of comparative religion courses, and they were eye opening. Once you realize what that aspect of human consciousness is all about, the darkness that is religion, the fear, the loathing, the terror of death. The terror of the ego trying to contemplate its own non-existence, which obviously is impossible. So what to do? Rather than get into that situation, just create something. I know, we'll call it religion. I find the whole thing horrible. I really do. The whole idea of religious belief, just horrifying. I can't drive 100 yards in, well, I'm exaggerating here, but not by much, anywhere in the South without stumbling across or driving past another huge edifice to this craziness. The churches, and the marquees that appear outside the churches are getting more and more confrontational, more and more disrespectful, more and more threatening. Now, I understand from an historical perspective that when things start to melt down, as they are now, and we haven't come anywhere close to the bottom of this societal economic meltdown we're involved in here, but when that starts to happen, of course, there is this clinging, this clutching, this clawing at something that one can cling to and claw onto and clutch to, and it's religious craziness instead of actual problem solving, instead of taking a look at all the things that are going on and saying, okay, there really are ways out of this. We are human beings. We have made some horrendous mistakes, but there are ways to correct this and set ourselves on the right path. And it's not the road to Damascus. There is not going to be that epiphanous moment when we change our names and then order all the women in church to shut the hell up. That's not it. It really isn't. So, you know, my point of view is pretty much the same as has always been in talk radio. I see religion as a hideously destructive force on every single possible level. And yet, around this time of year, each year, we acknowledge Christianity. I'm not going to do it this year. We will have a program that is can be called a Christmas Eve program if one chooses to, but we're going to make it our winter solstice program. Every year for, oh my God, for I don't know how many years I've been in radio, I go ahead and give in to that Christian belief system and put it out on the air. And I just have decided I'm not going to do it this year. So this is advance notice for you, if it means anything. It probably doesn't. And that's okay, too. So anyway, it never fails to make me sad. Not angry, but sad to realize how much human energy that could be used to really, really, really take a look at where we are and what we are and who we are and all the things that need to be corrected, how much of that energy is diverted into superstitious nonsense. It's very saddening. I'll see you tomorrow night. Okay, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Geico has...